Hello, and welcome to Alexander Disease Research Update, episode 11, recorded on July 26th, 2022. I'm Albie Messing from the Waisman Center at the University of Wisconsin, and with me for the first time is a new guest, Dr. Abby Olson from the University of Pittsburgh. Abby was the neurology expert and co-author on our publication last year describing the new rat model that we also discussed in episode 6. Abby, since this is your first time on, can you say a bit about your background and current position?
Sure. Thank you so much for having me on the podcast. It's really a delight to be here and to be able to bring the perspective of a neurologist to the podcast. So in terms of my background, I did my MD PhD degree at the University of Pennsylvania, followed by internship at Pennsylvania Hospital, and then a neurology residency in what was then the Partners Neurology Program, subsequently renamed to Mass General Brigham. That's in Boston. I then completed a fellowship in movement disorders, also at Mass General Brigham, followed by a few years as a junior faculty member at Brigham and Women's. And now I have moved to the University of Pittsburgh to launch my own lab. So basically, I'm a physician scientist, and the breakdown of my time is such that I spend most of my time in the lab doing basic science research, but then I also have a clinical practice as a movement disorders neurologist. So in that practice, I see mostly patients with Parkinson's disease, as well as atypical Parkinsonian syndromes that are similar to Parkinson's disease. But I also see patients with a lot of autonomic dysfunction and with ataxia, both of which are of course, relevant to Alexander disease. My only caveat I want to say for the purposes of this podcast is that I do only see adults. So I've seen adults with adult onset Alexander disease, but I don't see children in my clinical practice. So hopefully that gives you sort of the scope of what I do.
Great. And we should say that your postdoctoral research training was in Melfini's lab. So your model system that you're continuing with at Pittsburgh is the fly.
That's exactly right. So I use the combination of the fly as well as cell culture systems and also mice. But the fly is really the staple of the lab.
Great. Well, thanks for being here. Before we get started, please send feedback to AXDRU podcast@Waisman. That's W-A-I-S-M-A-N. .wisc.edu. The paper up for discussion today is by Gertler and colleagues and is entitled Adult Onset Alexander Disease, New Causal Sequence Variant in the GFAP Gene that was recently published in Neurology Genetics. And the goal of this study, it was a case report, an individual, and it describes the detection and evaluation of a variant in GFAP that hasn't been seen before, and in a region of the protein where variants are unusually sparse. So what I think the key message for patients and families is that simply by describing only the second known variant in the head domain of the protein, and we'll talk about that later, that might cause Alexander disease, it adds to our knowledge base in trying to connect changes in protein structure to the disease. So let me begin by just briefly covering the clinical history. This was a male, the youngest of three siblings. At the age of 56, he experienced some type of mild head trauma. We aren't told exactly what kind of head trauma. And then over the next year, developed progressive symptoms with walking, clumsiness, weakness, and dizziness. Later on, he developed problems with speech and swallowing. An MRI of his head and neck taken immediately after the head trauma showed atrophy of the brainstem and spinal cord in his neck region. So, Abby, how do you go about connecting his symptoms with the anatomy and the description of where the abnormalities are based on the MRI?
Yeah, so this is really the most common problem we are faced with as neurologists. So in neurology, we like to do what we call localizing the lesion, which basically means that when somebody comes in with a neurologic complaint, and they have specific signs or symptoms, we try to identify the area of the nervous system that is involved and responsible for those signs and symptoms. In some areas of neurology, this is easier than others. So for example, if somebody has a stroke and they have a really sudden neurologic deficit, we can often know, even without taking an image like an MRI, where the cause of that neurologic deficit is within the brain or the spinal cord or the rest of the nervous system. It's a little bit more challenging often in these chronic neurologic diseases and neurodegenerative diseases, where people often have many symptoms that develop gradually over time. We still use the general framework of trying to elicit all of the patient's symptoms and think about which areas of the brain or other nervous system regions might be responsible for those. And then we kind of use that thought approach to then guide further testing. So that's why if you go to a neurologist, you're hopefully not going to be getting every possible test of the nervous system. We don't want to be ordering a brain MRI, an MRI of the entire spinal cord, an EEG, an EMG, et cetera. We don't use every test at our disposal, but try to use them thoughtfully based on the complaints. So in this particular case, you know, his symptoms, one of the prominent ones was ataxia, and ataxia tends to point to the cerebellum. So that's where I would be sort of immediately thinking about, if I were hearing this case, is there a problem in the cerebellum? Likewise, dizziness is sort of a nonspecific symptom, but some types of dizziness can localize to the cerebellum as well.
Excuse me for a second. So perhaps you should explain a little bit more about what ataxia means. How is that different than unsteadiness or clumsiness?
Sure. Yep. So obviously ataxia is a term a neurologist would use. No patient comes in saying, I think I have ataxia. Although I should say now with the internet, that's not entirely true. I have definitely had patients come in saying they think they have ataxia. But typically what a patient would say is, I feel unsteady. I feel like I'm on a boat, or I feel like I'm drunk. That is sort of the colloquial language that is used for what we call ataxia. And the way we determine that somebody has ataxia is partly by the history of them using phrases like that, but then mostly by the physical exam. So in particular, we're looking for an ataxic gait. So gait is the fancy neurological word for walking. When someone has ataxia or an ataxic gait, they tend to have steps that are spaced widely apart. So the feet, instead of being relatively close to each other, are on a much wider base. And then the gait will be irregular. So there's a variability to the stride length and speed. And that's an ataxic gait. So when we see that, that's often a tip off that something is going wrong in the cerebellum.
So it's interesting that you mentioned sometimes confusion with drunkenness. I know of patients who have been almost arrested for drunk driving.
So yes, so this is actually a common story. I also have patients that have been in this boat and have even had to attest for patients that they have a neurological disease. And that is the explanation for this. The reason for that confusion is that alcohol also affects the cerebellum. So if you are overly intoxicated, then you may well look ataxic. You can have that wide gait, you can stagger. And the other test that's often used both in the neurology office and by police for something like drunk driving is the finger nose finger test, where we have patients point to their nose and then point to the examiner's finger and go back and forth. And with an intact cerebellum, you should be able to do that smoothly and accurately. Whereas if you're having a problem with your cerebellum, what will happen is as you near the end of the path and you're reaching the target, either the examiner's finger or your own nose, you start to kind of sway back and forth very, very irregularly. So that's also a sign of cerebellar dysfunction. That's actually mentioned in this paper. It's called dysmetria, is that specific neurological word. But that is also used both by police to look for drunkenness and also by neurologists to look for cerebellar dysfunction, because it's another sign that localizes to the cerebellum.
This fellow was also mentioned as having dysarthria. So is slurred speech one aspect of dysarthria?
Yes. So dysarthria is a very general term. So dysarthria broadly refers to a problem with speech that is due to a motor problem. And that is to distinguish it from an aphasia mostly. So when we say aphasia in neurology, that is a problem with language where you're having difficulty speaking because the brain is having a hard time understanding how language works and the rules of language. Dysarthria, in contrast, is not a problem with language. So you're able to understand language and your brain knows what you want to say and how to you know, use language. But the problem is a motor problem where something is going wrong with the muscles needed to physically make the speech. And there can be many reasons for dysarthria, and we describe it in many ways. Basically, since it's a muscle problem, the problem can arise from either weakness of the muscles that are necessary for speech. It can arise from a problem in the muscle tone in the muscles that are necessary for speech. So the muscles can be either too rigid or they can be too soft and then they don't work correctly. Or it can be a problem with coordination of the muscles that are needed for speech. And those different types of dysarthria, whether it's due to muscle weakness, muscle tone, or muscle coordination, actually sound different when the person who is dysarthric speaks. And so we use the specific way that the dysarthria sounds to tell us what is the underlying problem. So in the case of cerebellar dysfunction, that can cause what we would call a cerebellar dysarthria, or it's sometimes called scanning speech. And there, what the problem is a problem of muscle coordination. So people can either have slurred speech or they can have this scanning speech where the prosody of speech is off. So they almost sound like they're speaking in Morse code because without the cerebellum to sort of regulate the rate and the coordination of the muscles, the speech can come out very, very choppy. So it can be, you know, I went to the store yesterday, and there's these pauses, or it can be slurred, which again is where you will be mistaken possibly for being drunk. We've all heard people who are overly intoxicated slur their speech before. And both of those things are types of dysarthria that can indicate a problem in the cerebellum.
Well, we're spending a lot of time on drunkenness. Do you recommend that patients carry some sort of card with them saying that they have a neurological disease?
I actually have done that before for some of my adult patients. Presumably, this is not an issue, right? I think, for pediatric patients. But yes, I actually have done that before. I mean, the reality, unfortunately, with these diseases is that as the diseases progress, you may not be able to drive anyway, and then this becomes less of an issue. But yes, I have really recommended that because you can really be mistaken for being intoxicated.
And what in this history would you attribute to bulbar problems?
Right. So bulbar problems, when we use the term bulbar in neurology, that refers to problems that localize to the brainstem. The reason we call it bulbar is that the pons, which is part of the brainstem, looks sort of like a bulb, like an onion bulb in terms of its shape. And so that's really where that term comes from. That's not obvious. Bulbar problems tend to also include dysarthria. It's a slightly different type of dysarthria than cerebellar dysarthria, but it will also be a type of dysarthria. Dysphagia, meaning difficulty swallowing. So those are two of the biggest ones. And then I know we're going to talk a little bit about autonomic dysfunction. We don't tend to call that specifically bulbar, but it can often arise due to problems in the brainstem, both the pons and the lower brainstem as well. So probably the two biggest are dysarthria and dysphagia.
Well, let's move on to autonomic problems. So in this case report, they actually say that he did not have any autonomic problems, but maybe now is a good time to talk a little bit about what is the autonomic nervous system and what are the kinds of problems in the autonomic nervous system that you find in Alexander disease.
Yeah, so I have a real interest in the autonomic nervous system. It is a fascinating part of the nervous system that is not studied enough and is not appreciated enough, in my opinion. When I'm explaining the autonomic nervous system to patients, I often tell them they should think about it as the automatic nervous system, because much of what it does are things that are normally automatic for us that we don't have to think about in any way. So as you know, examples, it controls many aspects of our breathing, our heart rate, our blood pressure. It controls temperature regulation. It controls the motility of the entire gastrointestinal system, urinary function, erectile function, and really all of the fluids that the body makes. So it also controls sweating, salivation, tear production, et cetera. So it does quite a lot of things. And most of us, these things are all happening in, you know, in the background without us ever, you know, realizing what's going on there. But anyone who's having problems with the autonomic nervous system will tell you that when things go wrong, they can really go wrong and make life awfully miserable. The way that the autonomic nervous system actually works is it's a series of incredibly complex interactions between basically all parts of the nervous system. So the anatomy is quite complicated. It starts in the brain, all the way up in the highest regions of the brain, in what we call the cortex. There's a high level of sort of regulatory oversight from the brain of the autonomic nervous system. There are also lower regions of the brain. For example, the amygdala and the hypothalamus are areas of the brain that control fear and both physical and psychological stress. And that is what really explains how emotions and stress can come into play in the autonomic nervous system. Probably everybody has had the experience of, you know, being nervous and having butterflies in your stomach or diarrhea. That's from those areas of the brain interacting with the nervous system. Further down, the brainstem is one of the sort of real hearts of the autonomic nervous system. So there are many structures on all levels of the brain and brainstem, but especially in the lower part of the brainstem, the medulla, that is very much affected in Alexander disease. There are really important what we call relay centers. So basically, these relay centers in the medulla, they take all of the information that's coming in from the periphery, so from the nerves in the body, from all of the organs, and they sort of integrate it and send it up to the brain. And then vice versa, they take the sort of brain's response that is coming back down from the brain, integrate that, process it, and send it back down through the nerves to the various organs. And so I think of the medulla basically as like, if you were taking a trip and you had to make a connection. So if I'm, you know, living in Pittsburgh and I want to go to Paris, I probably can't go straight there. I have to stop in New York City. And if New York City is out, I'm not going to be able to get from Pittsburgh to Paris. And someone who wants to get from Paris to Pittsburgh is not going to be able to do it either. That's sort of, you know, the way that I think about this, you know, very much in layman's terms, that in the medulla, if you have pathology in those relay centers, you have kind of dysfunction of the entire system, basically, because you've taken out a real central point in what is a very large and complex network.
So let me move on to the genetics now. After about a year, when he was 57, with this progressive worsening of his symptoms and the MRI findings, including atrophy of the medulla and spinal cord, his doctors decided to pursue a genetic diagnosis. They did whole exome sequencing. They found a variant in GFAP that's never been seen before at position 58. Which converts a leucine to a proline. So it's referred to as L58P. This is very interesting to those of us who try to think about how variants in GFAP cause Alexander disease, because as you may remember, GFAP is divided into three main regions. There's a central rod domain, which is the bulk of the protein. And then there are these flanking head and tail domains. But GFAP is 432 amino acids long. The head domain is amino acids 1 through 62. The rod domain is 63 to 370. To date, only two variants have been identified in the head domain, this being the second one, whereas over 100 have been identified, or around 100 have been identified in the rod and tail domain. So it is very unusual to have a variant in the head domain. And there's all sorts of speculation about why that's the case. We don't really know what it means. So finding the variant is one thing, trying to convince yourself that it's really responsible for this person's problems is quite another. And the way these investigators pursued that was using an artificial system in cell culture using HeLa cells. These are an epithelial cell line derived from a cervical carcinoma, I believe. And they introduced the GFAP, either the variant or the normal form of GFAP, into the HeLa cells and watched how it integrated into the cytoskeletal network of HeLa cells. So HeLa cells are probably expressing a collection of vimentin and maybe a couple of different keratins, I'm not sure. So normal GFAP will assemble into a filamentous network, but this L58P variant GFAP instead was aggregation prone and instead formed these clumps. So together with the MRI findings, which I think were quite consistent with Alexander disease, and this aggregation prone behavior of the GFAP in cell culture, the authors convinced themselves that this was causative. I would have preferred a different word in the title than the one that was used, new causal sequence. I think it was associated with this Alexander disease, but I think it's not proof. It's consistent with Alexander disease, but it's not proof. So Abby, what do you think the key message of this paper is for patients and families to understand?
Yeah, so I think, you know, the key message scientifically, of course, is that it does suggest that these other regions of GFAP may also be important in the disease pathogenesis. In terms of the sort of key message clinically, you know, this is a case report, so it's really a single patient. It doesn't tell us a whole lot for patients more broadly. But I do think, you know, I would commend the authors a bit for at least trying to show that this mutation may cause pathology. They've sort of only scratched the surface of doing that by just looking in the HeLa cell system, which is not the most, you know, relevant system to Alexander disease. But as a clinician, I will say we often find ourselves in this boat where we've done genetic sequencing on somebody, we find a variant of unknown significance, and we are sometimes left really scratching our heads trying to figure out what the potential meaning of that is and whether it really has anything to do with the symptoms the person is having or not. So if anything, it would be nice, I guess, if more clinicians tried to do some experiments.
And then there's the whole issue of head trauma and whether that's really provoking a sudden acceleration of the disease, appearance and acceleration of the disease. What do you think about the head trauma story?
Yeah, exactly. This is, I would say, a kind of an unknown in neurology in general. So many neurodegenerative diseases have a reported association with head trauma. And I will say my personal opinion is that I'm a little bit skeptical of the causality there, although there's a lot that we just don't understand. The reasons for my skepticism are a couple. For one, head trauma is quite common. So, you know, many people have head trauma and they never develop any neurological disease of any kind. There's a problem that we call recall bias, where if you have developed a neurological disease, you're very likely to remember any head trauma that you've had before, particularly if a neurologist asks you if you've had head trauma. There's also the problem of this, we sometimes call this pseudo-acute onset. So for many, many chronic diseases, they are sort of simmering in the background. And, you know, even for a disease that's gradually developing over months to years, for many people, there's sort of a day at which you really notice it. And very often that day can be a day where something else happened. So I will often see patients, for example, with something like Parkinson's disease, who are very sure that their Parkinson's started immediately after they had a surgery. And probably what has happened there is not that, you know, a surgery doesn't give you Parkinson's disease, but, you know, you had some sort of physical stress on the body, you're not quite your full self, and you're starting to notice a lot of symptoms that may have been building up very, very slowly in the background that were sort of beneath your, you know, detection level. So I worry that with something like head trauma, it's possible that it's somewhat incidental and it just serves as a good calendar marker for when something, you know, started, even if really that process was brewing under the surface. All that said, there's much that we don't understand about how head trauma works. And so, yes, it is possible, I think, that if you have some sort of predisposition to a neurological disease or you have some slowly developing neurological disease, it is at least theoretically possible that a head trauma can be a sort of second hit or sort of push that process over the edge or accelerate something that was, you know, already beginning. In this particular, this is the last thing I'll say about this, but in this particular case, I believe they obtained an MRI at the time of the head trauma that already showed some atrophy, so some cell loss in the medulla and the cervical spinal cord, which to me suggests that this pathological process began prior to the head trauma. Whether the head trauma then accelerated it in some way is a little bit more challenging of a question to answer.
All right. Now for some email. You can send your questions to axdrupodcast@waisman.wisc.edu, and we'll try our best to address them in a future podcast. Please send any feedback about these podcasts to the same email. Mark writes, "It strikes me that the burden of disease at any point in time is governed by a balance between the production of aberrant GFAP, the location of affected cells, in the sense that a relatively small amount produced in the wrong place could have a disproportionately large impact, and the capacity to clear the GFAP. With respect to this latter issue, what dictates this ability to defend against the higher GFAP expression? Is it also genetically determined? And do different parts of the brain display heterogeneity in this process?" There's a lot here. Let me break it down into four main questions. First, we do think of GFAP levels as reflecting a balance between synthesis and degradation with genetic influences on both sides. Second, not all astrocytes are the same, and location plays a big part in neurology. Abby has already talked quite a bit about that, and we'll have more to say about it in a minute. So it's certainly possible, or I should say plausible, that where the accumulations occur will partly determine the kinds of symptoms that develop. Third, as I said, not all astrocytes are the same. And for instance, those in spinal cord are quite distinct from those in brainstem and hypothalamus. And fourth, different brain regions probably do differ in their capacity to deal with the GFAP variants and excess. With regard to genetics and degradation, the last podcast, number 10, included brief mention of another disorder, giant axonal neuropathy, which is an autosomal recessive condition caused by defects in the GAN gene. The protein encoded by GAN is called gigaxonin, and it regulates the degradation of most, if not all, of the intermediate filaments. It gets its name from the initial pathology that was recognized involving peripheral nerve axons and accumulations of neurofilaments, but it turns out that these individuals develop plenty of Rosenthal fibers in their astrocytes as well. So certainly there are genetic influences here on the side of degradation, and we're just at the beginning of learning about these. Another question from Mark. Do you think that in the future, we will be using some sort of GFAP burden score to inform decisions about treatments? I'll give you my personal opinion here. There's a lot of individual variation in the levels of GFAP that show up in blood and CSF. For those with Alexander disease, the levels go up, but that means from whatever their starting point was. It gets tricky to compare one patient with another. For those getting antisense treatment, it's important to know that GFAP goes down because that indicates that the ASO is working as planned. But beyond that, it's really too early in our understanding of the disease and the potential response to treatment to really know how to use the information about GFAP levels just yet. We're all spending a lot of time looking for additional biomarkers, which is to say things that we can measure in blood and CSF that would help guide decisions about treatments. Mark's last couple of questions are, the data on spinal cord abnormalities, and now he's talking about the rat, took him by surprise. Did the rats have clinical manifestations that could be directly attributed to spinal cord pathology? So atrophy of the cervical cord is one of the cardinal features of the later onset forms of the disease. But tying the anatomy to the symptoms gets pretty complicated. Abby, can you help us understand how you connect the rat's problems with grip strength and coordination with anatomy?
Yes. So it's kind of similar to what we do in people. Whenever we see a problem, we do try to localize the lesion and think about which parts of the nervous system are responsible for that deficit. In this particular case, the problems of grip strength and coordination can be a little bit hard to tie back to one very specific area of the brain or nervous system. That's partly because something like grip strength actually requires input really from the entire nervous system. So there's input coming from the brain, from the spinal cord, from the peripheral nerves, et cetera, that all go into the function of grip strength. In this case, we know from the pathology that the rats do have a lot of obvious pathology in the spinal cord. So it may well be that that's where the lesion is that's causing the grip strength problem, but you wouldn't necessarily know that because that type of a symptom can really come from, you know, diffuse processes throughout the nervous system.
And Mark also asks about whether the spinal cord could be responsible in people who have autonomic problems.
So yeah, when we see autonomic nervous system problems in people, we know that those can involve really any part of the nervous system, but that includes the spinal cord, particularly when we see people with multiple different types of autonomic problems that can suggest that the problem is either higher up or very diffuse. So the spinal cord is quite involved in the autonomic nervous system. Basically, information that is coming down through those brainstem relay centers, goes into the spinal cord. It goes to all different levels of the spinal cord from the cervical down to the sacral. And then the nerves that leave the spinal cord carry that information to the different end organs, whether that be the heart or the gut or the bladder or your sweat glands. And that is how that information is conveyed to those end organs. Those same nerves also take sensory information from the end organs and they send it back up through the spinal cord, through all of those levels, back to the brainstem and back up to the brain. So the spinal cord is in some ways like a big highway going from the brain down to the eventual organs.
I will say that right now we don't have any evidence that the rats have problems with the autonomic nervous system, but we're actively studying that to try to find out. That's all for today's episode of Alexander Disease Research Update. Thanks for listening, and thank you to Abby for joining me today. Our theme song was written by Charlie Allenson, special technical assistance from my daughters, Zoe and Rebecca, and from Clark Kellogg at the UW's Waisman Center. And thanks to our donors for these podcasts, the Barrett-Riddle family. I'm Albie Messing. See you next time.